All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. Quick heads up, looks like calls and questions are starting to roll pretty quick. The first hour is the power hour, all about engines, maintenance, troubleshooting. Second hour is going to be destination health. Start lining up questions. If you have a question for either show, go ahead and press 1 on your phone now. We'll destination health calls, but I'll be holding you through that first hour. But the sooner you get in, the better your chances. So you want to talk about either topic, press 1 on your phone right now, and we'll start screening those calls. We're going to get started.
Success in the trucking industry. This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs. Back in your pocket.
Welcome to the world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, working with brokers. This goes on. If you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone, give us a call. We're doing a special show with the power. Joining me from Pittsburgh Power is Bruce Mallinson and Leroy, and we're going to be talking about maintenance and troubleshooting and everything engine and performance and fuel mileage related. Leroy, Bruce, welcome to the show, you guys.
Hi, Kevin.
Thank you. Thanks for having us, Kevin. Can you hear me on this other phone?
Yep, yep. You sound good. You're at. Sounds like you're out on the road traveling, though.
I am. I'm calling from a portable phone, so I just wanted to make sure I was clear.
Can hear you, and we've got all kinds of questions lined up for tonight. We always do when you guys are on. Before we get to those questions, anything you guys want to start with?
Yes, I want to say that two really good friends of mine, Carl Kellner, that runs a 2WS Cat and a 379 Pete, and Mike Lane, that runs a 14-liter Detroit and a Western Star, both called with interesting statements this past week. Carl Kellner had a guy back into his front end, so he's driving a company truck right now, and it's a stock 550 Cat. And he called me, and he's shocked at how sluggish it is and how it's not an enjoyable day driving this stock truck, and he can't wait to get back into his high-performance Cat. And Mike Lane just bought a brand-new Polaris snowmobile, and he told the dealer he wants a snowmobile that will run as good as his Western Star. And he just took 2 weeks of Christmas and New Year's off the snowmobile, got back in the truck yesterday. He said, you know, the new Polaris snowmobile runs almost as good as my Western Star. I'm happy. So it's nice to get reports back like that. And over the past 39 years, we've always proven that a high-performance diesel engine, properly driven, will get better fuel mileage, live longer, and certainly be a whole lot more fun to drive. It'll actually give you passion for driving.
You know, that's interesting, and it's something you and I have talked about. We've said this before. We kind of came at this whole thing from opposite ends. You had always built really high-performance engines. And most of those years, especially people who were building those kind of engines, just didn't care much about fuel economy, which was fine. That was their choice. Fuel wasn't that expensive. And I came from the other end, even when fuel was 80 cents a gallon. I was working on fuel economy just because I was interested in it and I saved money. And it took us a while to realize that they both worked really well together. Typically, we thought of high performance as getting poor fuel economy because sometimes people would run it as a high performance engine. And you and I got together and really figured out that we were both doing a lot of the same things to just get a different result. And 95% of everything you and I were doing, either in the middle and we did realize the better you build that engine, the more performance you build into it, the more efficient you get the horsepower. If you drive it right, the fuel economy goes up, and you get all the benefits you just talked about. It's much more enjoyable to drive, and it's just a joy to have a truck that's built that way. So it's been a great relationship, and we continue to learn stuff, so I love doing the show together now.
Al Hemerson called me this morning. He's got 40-some thousand pounds of shrimp in his reefer coming across Kansas, running in 12th gear, holding his tack at 1,520 or 30 RPM, putting out 7.9 mile per gallon out of his 14-liter and his Freightliner. And we have that set up pretty well, and we even have our high-performance Caterpillar turbo on that. And I forget what his speed was, but he was sitting there at 3 and 4 pounds of boost coming across Kansas.
Wow. Yeah, that's a great sign. That engine's just barely working at all. All right. Well, anything else, or should we jump into some phone calls?
But maybe Leroy has something to add.
Leroy, go ahead.
We certainly had a busy last couple days, that's for sure. We have a bunch of trucks in the shop right now. We're actually really overloaded. Yesterday, we had an interesting issue with the DDEC 5 came in. His complaint was he had low power and low fuel mileage, and he had a program done by someone else. We put on the dyno, and it struggled to even make 400 horsepower.
Ooh.
And about 2 days, we kind of beat the fuel system all up, you know, checked over everything, because the guy said, I just put injectors in this truck. He's like, there's no way that can be it. We've seen it time and time again that it's injectors, he says, but they're new. I was like, okay. He's like, well, they're not new. They're 200,000 miles old or something like that. So we you know, chased around everything that we could think of for 2 days. And me and Ethan both were like, you know, it is injectors. Can we just try a set of injectors? We're, you know, 99% sure that's it. And sure enough, we put on a dyno, and he makes 650 horsepower now out of his DDEC 5.
Wow.
Now, we turned it back down, but, yeah, he had no problems with power after that.
So 200,000 miles on a set of Reman injectors, and they were bad.
Yep.
And, Kevin, a lot of times we get trucks in with 800,000 miles on the injectors. The truck runs smooth. It doesn't miss, but it just, you cannot get horsepower out of it. You put a fresh set of injectors in, and away you go. 800,000 seems to be the magic number. Once you're over 800,000, you start to lose power. Chances are it's injectors or a restricted fuel line.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, what's interesting is that, you know, my operation was quite a bit different. I didn't need a lot of horsepower. We weren't pulling heavy. We had flat ground. It was Florida and Georgia. The last 5 or 6 years of my contract with FedEx, I had three trucks that only ran Florida and Georgia. And really, almost every one of my 60 series went a million plus miles, and I never touched injectors. I mean, I would usually sell mine around 1.2, 1.3 million, and I would never do an in-frame, never do injectors, never do turbos. I mean, I just almost never worked on the engine, and I got spoiled.
But your engines weren't high horsepower, and you were running fairly level terrain.
Yeah, exactly. So
if you're on level terrain, you might not notice it. If you spent your whole day in Illinois, say, you might not notice the bad injectors.
If it was a matter of, like you're saying, after 800,000, you start to gradually lose power, I would have never noticed that. We just didn't put the truck under enough load to really know, and mm-hmm. It worked well. But the injector problem, the Reman injectors, it really seems to be getting worse all the time.
Well, the U.S. manufacturers have all gone south of the border to have the everything Reman. So sometimes you get the elevator, sometimes you get the shaft. You ever But we've been very successful, yeah, though, with reman injectors from Detroit Cat and Cummins. We really haven't seen the problem that other people say they're having. Use Lucas fuel conditioner because it adds lubricity to the diesel fuel and it helps save the injectors.
You know, between that and the FAS, you know, the FAS cleaning up the fuel so well and getting the air out of there is much better for that injector as well. And I think a lot of people are having more luck with injectors because they're doing the right things.
I agree. By taking the air out with the FAS, it also affects your timing because the air gathers in the injector cup. You have to compress the fuel first, or to compress the air first, and then the fuel gets injected second. That's why the engines pull smoother and they pull stronger, because the air's not down in the injector cup anymore.
Yeah, and that air coming through that injector tip first is really hard on the injector.
And back in the, about 96, 97, Cummins Engineering did a study on that, and that was a quote from Mark Chappell, the performance Cummins engineer.
Outstanding.
We're
going to get to a break. We're going to come right back, and then we're going to jump into some phone calls. So stick around. We'll be right back with more stuff. I'm Kevin Rutter. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Joining me from Pittsburgh Power today, Bruce and Leroy, and we are getting ready to head to the phones. Let's get started right there in Pennsylvania. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. It's me again with the C12. Good to talk to you all. I got an oil sample. We have some sodium and potassium that's expected. I just had to put a water pump in, and this is the first oil since pump was put in, and it is down from the level of the last sample when we caught it. But there's a crazy amount of copper. And other than that, I don't think there's much to talk about, but I'll let you take it away.
What is your silicon rating? Oh, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, Kevin. Bruce, I'll jump in and I'll let you guys follow up because I've got the sample here in front of me. So, Brian, I agree. The sodium and potassium both went down. That's a pretty clear indication that the water pump was the problem. It's fixed, and we've just got residual in there. So you'll see that just keep going down. That's a good sign. Little bit of lead, nothing to be concerned about. Copper went through the roof, but it's on its own. So when we see copper by itself, if lead didn't precede it, and when I say your lead is a little elevated, it's at 7. That's nothing. Your copper's over 500. Now, if we see lead climbing and then we start to see copper, that's an indication we've gone through the outer coating of the bearing and now we're working on the inner coating, which would be a really bad sign. But you would see copper in the 30 or 40 range, not 500. When we see 500, it is almost always just a cooler of some sort. The oil cooler is the most likely. EGR coolers can possibly do that. So when it happens, we don't even worry about it. that number means nothing. It doesn't even mean there's anything wrong with the cooler. For some reason, they will just start leaching out copper even though there's nothing wrong with them. So you can ignore that. Bruce, for your question, the silicon did jump. It had been running in the 4 and 5 range, and it was up to 15. So it's either while they were working on the engine, they got a little dirt in there, maybe.
That's what I'm thinking. Okay. Wow, when you said 500 on the copper, that was a shock to me. I've never seen one that high.
Oh, we see it. You know, we see up in the multiple hundred all the time, and yet nothing is wrong. Sometimes it happens when the oil cooler's new. Sometimes it happens when the cooler is 10 years old. And for some reason, and nobody's ever been able to explain it to me, they will just leach copper out into the oil. There's nothing wrong with them.
Okay. Two other thoughts. I don't know what you guys think. Is it possible that a Cat Reman water pump would have any copper in it?
No,
there's no copper in a water pump. There's a ceramic seal, and it rides on like a piece of Bakelite, and you have a steel shaft, and you either have a plastic impeller or a cast iron impeller. And if it's a plastic impeller, the part that goes over the steel shaft is steel. It's like a steel circle with the plastic molded to the outside of it. There's no copper in a water pump.
Okay. The only other thought I had was this was the first time I took a sample using one of those handy like ball valve drain plug things. I don't know if there's any copper in that.
Okay.
No.
You know, that might be possible.
I've seen those. I've never really seen copper in it. It's usually a ball that sits in like a Teflon plastic, like a ball and socket. So I don't think that's where it's coming from.
Okay.
The good news here, though, Brian, is when we see copper jump to those crazy high numbers like that, worst case scenario, you could be looking at an oil cooler or an EGR cooler that's failing. But about 9 times out of 10, it's not. We don't know why this happens, and then sometimes it just goes away.
C12 shouldn't have an EGR cooler on it.
Right.
Correct.
Right. I was just saying in general, but we'd only have to be thinking about the oil cooler.
Right. That's what I would be looking to. If that was mine, I'd probably be replacing it.
Okay.
Yeah, it can't hurt. Can't hurt, but a lot of times, like I say, we see it, it goes away. If the coolant comes back and we have high copper, when we see coolant and high copper, then we know there's a good chance the oil cooler is failing and we're getting contamination.
But let's look. This thing is a 2002 or older engine. It wouldn't hurt to replace the cooler on your time versus whenever it breaks.
Yep, good point.
Okay, sounds good.
All right,
hey,
good stuff. Thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Here's something we noticed recently. We had an ISX in with a cracked valve cover, and we have right now leaving a Detroit in a T600 Kenworth with the air filter under the hood. Both were damaged from people at truck washes standing on the valve cover and standing on the air filter while washing the roof of the truck.
Ah, yeah. Good point. I see that all the time.
So the ISX, the Detroit, both have plastic valve covers. You cannot stand on top of the engine. And by all means, never stand on top of an air filter. The one with the air filter wiped out the engine. It went to 27 parts per million on silicon before we caught it.
Oh, yeah. You know, the just again another, you know, example of good oil analysis and watching it. And a lot of times we catch things like that, but the best way would be to avoid it. Don't be standing on that stuff.
That's right. If you want to clean the roof of the truck, use a step ladder.
Yeah, well, and especially the truck should have all stuff available. They should be opening up the hood and climbing around on things. Let's go to Iowa. David, welcome to the program.
You talking to me, Kevin?
I am. It's your turn.
Hey, I woke up to dead batteries this morning, so I heard your call. It was about a week ago, talking about the ESM and going with the deep cycle batteries. What would your opinion be of just changing the batteries out to regular batteries again, and then putting? I can buy a small generator with a 10-amp battery charger for $600. What do you think of that system?
That might not be a bad way to go. You're still going to go through a lot of batteries. I mean, I guess that could save you in an emergency where you were able to start up the generator, then use the generator to charge the batteries, then use the batteries to start the truck. But that can take a while. If you get four big Group 31 batteries dead, that's not a lot of amperage. You're going to sit there a long time waiting for them to charge. It could work. You could also wake up one morning and you haven't used the generator in a while. Now it won't start. So it's a solution. It's certainly a little cheaper. Not really a lot cheaper, though.
Well, I found batteries at home for $85 a piece right now, regular Group 31s, and the generator is $600. I mean, I could do those do the whole thing for $1,000, as opposed to like the ESM for $1,000 itself.
Yeah.
My thoughts on the generator work is when you pull in and park in the afternoon, you know you're going to be there for 12 or 15 hours. Fire the generator up and let it trickle charge the batteries.
You could do that. I like to think long term. So in one case you're going to spend $2,000 on the ESM and you won't. It's about $1,700 because you're only buying three Optima batteries. So let's call it $1,700 one way, $1,000 the other. You've got some problems if you don't, have everything running overnight and you wake up to dead batteries. You could have some downtime and waiting. The other thing is those standard $85 Group 31 batteries, you're going to go through them every year. If you've got hotel loads, you're going to replace those every year. And you've got the fuel and the maintenance on the generator. The ESM lasts the life of the truck and would probably go through two more trucks that you owned, and the Optima batteries will probably last you 3 to 4 years. So your four-year cost is probably much lower, and you've got a better system. So hold that thought. We'll come back and talk about it right after this break. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rothbard. Before the break, we were talking with David in Iowa. So David, it's certainly a solution. It would work. I could see some problems possibly where it wouldn't be quite as easy, cheaper in the short term. But I actually think in the long run, the ESM and the top of the line cycle batteries would be cheaper.
Yeah, in the long term, I believe you're correct. How long? I've got a pretty good hotel load on here, 2,500 watt inverter, block heater, Wabasso block heater, Wabasso bunk heaters. How long would the deep cycle batteries hold out? How long would they last?
You know, I mean, for
an individual cycle, I mean.
Right, right. I won't be able to give you an answer, but I can tell you how you figure it out. You can you go online, you look up the battery itself. The battery will give you amp hours that it has available. So you can multiply that by three. You've got three of them in the group. Then you go and look at each item that you're going to run, and somewhere in their information you should be able to find an amp draw. And then you can calculate and actually get pretty close to how long they're going to last you.
Okay. Okay. Good enough. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time. You don't get Pittsburgh Power on so often, so I'll say thank you and let you go. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Good stuff. Anything you guys want to add to that? All right. We'll move on to another call. Let's go. Go ahead.
Kevin, I was going to say I lost it temporarily there. Leroy, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
To the ESM situation?
Yeah.
Right.
The only thing I guess I wanted to say was he was asking about deep cycle batteries versus the regular batteries. Like you said, you have to consider the fact that deep cycle batteries have a larger reserve capacity, which means that they can hold a high current for longer than a typical starting battery, a lead acid battery, but they don't provide the cold cranking amps. So if you wanted to try, you know, to start your truck off of deep cycle batteries, they're not really meant to be discharged fully like that. So the like a Maxwell would be probably better suited in his situation.
Well, the ESM, a lot of people, and I do it because it's just shorter. The ESM is the engine start module, which is Maxwell. Really, I totally agree. I love the deep cycle for, and he said he has heavy hotel loads. They're not great for starting the truck. We put the Maxwell ESM on there, the engine start module, and that takes care of all of our cooking. So I really think that is the configuration. All right, let's head off this time to Rusty in Arizona. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Kevin. Just to touch on the last caller there, you mentioned the batteries of your choice there. They're not the best. The North Star batteries are actually made from virgin lead versus the I can't remember the name brand you just mentioned. They're made from recycled lead, which only have a 2-year warranty, where the North Star batteries are an additional $50 more, and they have a 4-year warranty. So that might be a consideration for deep cycle batteries.
There could be batteries that are better. I've tested the MAs, and the red tops are excellent, you know, as far as I've tested them. But, yeah, the North Star could be a great choice as well.
Yeah. So my question, though, was about oil. I'm currently at 9.65 miles per gallon for a 30-day average, and I'm wanting to go up from there, of course. But I'm currently running a 1540 oil, synthetic oil. Is it beneficial to go to a 1030 synthetic? I run Arizona and Arizona only, and I never run below 32 degrees out, but I do run into the 110 in the summers. You know, early summer and then late summer when I do run. But I don't run June, July, August, September.
Got it. All right. So, well, I'll jump in, and then Bruce and Leroy, you guys can tell us what you've been seeing in the shop. You know, for decades, all we ever ran were 1540 traditional oils, conventional oils. And then we started getting into 1540 or 540 synthetics, which I really liked. I moved to synthetics really early, and I like them a lot. Just recently, in the last couple of years, we've seen 30 weight oils come into the market. And the reason for it is the OEMs are struggling to try to figure out how they're going to meet these government standards on fuel economy. And one of the things they're doing is 30 weight oils. So they've been on the market a while now. And I saw a test. We've used them. We saw fuel economy improvements. I haven't seen any problems in oil samples. I haven't seen increased wear metals. And I saw a test where they took, I think it was 5 engines, and they ran them all to about 500,000 miles. 4 of them had 40 weight oils, and only one of the engines had a 30 weight oil. And they tore the engines apart, and they laid out all the parts, and they brought in a bunch of master technicians and said, can you tell us which engine has more wear? And they were all so close that even the ones that had more wear, somebody thought they could measure more wear. It wasn't necessarily the engine with the 30. That was the concern. With 38 will give a fuel economy, but we didn't know if a 30 weight would hold up as well. It not that one particular test, it seemed to. So I kind of like leaning towards the 30 weight. What do you guys think?
Well, on the newer vehicles, they're calling for the 5W20, such as the gasoline engines. The 540 I'm using in my Dodge Cummins because of the winter time. But I don't really can't say that I've tore engines apart that were run their whole life on the 5W30 to compare. I guess if, so long as the oil is kept clean, you're going to be okay. But in Arizona, I think I might want to stay with the 540.
The heavier weight in really hot temperatures could be, we know it would give better protection. The question is whether or not the 30 weight would give enough. And the testing probably hasn't been done in just a hot climate only. So we may find down the line that in some cases the 30 weights aren't protecting enough.
Well, one thing that kind of comes to mind to me about synthetics versus the traditional mineral base is the fact that synthetics are better as oil temperature changes, it maintains its temperature better than mineral base. So, for instance, at lower ambient temperatures, mineral oil is thicker, which causes increased fuel consumption, whereas synthetic oil is less affected by temperature. But on the same hand, as oil gets hotter towards 200 degrees or so, it has less mile per gallon loss than a full synthetic because the fact that the synthetic is maintaining its temperature, while the mineral based oil is becoming less, has less viscosity as it gets hotter.
Yeah, good point. So we've really got two issues going on, weight and whether or not we're using conventional or synthetic. So far, and I look at a lot of oil samples, and I've been watching the 30 weights. I've been watching for years, and like I say, I'm a fan of synthetic oil. But the 30 weights so far don't seem to be showing any problems in the oil sample. And like I say, the market is certainly moving that way. And on the new trucks, that's what's going to be standard. Let's see. I know we've got some more calls here. Let's go to Texas. Vince, welcome to the program. Vince, are you with us? Vince, I think I'm going to put you back on hold. We'll come back and try to get to that one in a second. Let's go to Utah. Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Bruce. Got a question about our 2016 Volvo. We keep them. It's got the Delco on the fuel filter. It's got the glass dome on it.
Karen, hold that thought. I wasn't paying attention to the clock. It snuck up on me. We're going to get to a break, and we will come back and get to more of your calls and questions. You're listening to the Power Hour. I'm Kevin Robert. All right, a quick heads up. We're heading into segment four. We'll get to as many calls as we can. And at the end, I'm going to say goodnight, goodbye, all that stuff. Don't hang up because we're going to come back and do an hour of Destination Health. So here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Joining me today, Bruce and Leroy from Pittsburgh Power. And we had a question there about a 2016 Volvo, but unfortunately, we lost that one. So we're going to head to Florida. Al, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind today?
I spoke with you a few weeks back. I'm going this weekend to look at a 2003 Volvo with a 600 Cummins. And everything he's told me so far, I've been okay with, except for the fact that he said that when it idles for a long time, it smokes very bad. Is that something I need to be concerned about?
What type of smoke is it? Is it bluish? Is it white? Is it black?
It sounded like it was black.
Black smoke after it idles for a long time. I wonder if the coolant temperature is getting too cold. Maybe it needs new thermostats. You could possibly, if you get below 140 degrees, get some smoke at an idle. But, man, I'm really surprised at that one. Leroy, do you have any ideas in the ECM programming?
It was rebuilt about 200,000 miles ago.
Okay. You said this was an Leroy? 03 ISX, right?
Yeah, 600 ISX.
Non-EGR, correct?
Non-EGR.
Okay.
The way that fuel injection system works, it has the fueling actuators and such. You may be having a leaky injector, even though it's because it doesn't fire individual injectors. It only loads the injectors, you know, multiple at a time. So it's possible for an injector to be leaking, even though it's not being asked to be fired.
How would I determine that?
Well, you can do an injector leak down test. It's pretty simple to do. Cummins has a special tool that you put over top of your fueling actuator. You put that on there. You crank the engine over without, you know, with the actuators unplugged, obviously, so it doesn't start. And you check for air in that line. And what that will tell you if the injector is leaking, allowing compression to come back through, and you'll see air bubbles inside your cup of water. Based on when the air bubble comes through, you can tell which cylinder exactly it is.
Oh, okay.
Now, if you wanted to do it the old school way, before computers, you would pull the turbo, pull the exhaust manifold, plug the turbo feed line, start the truck up, and let it idle, and stand to the side and look and see which cylinder the smoke is coming out of.
I mean, I'll pass on that.
It's nice to know both ways.
Now, if the smoke is a different color than black, what might it be?
Well, if it's blue, that means it's oil. Okay. And then we also have to determine, do we have some oil possibly coming out of the turbine side of the turbocharger? Because exhaust back pressure and turbo boost keep the oil in the compressor housing. So whenever you're idling, you do not have turbo boost and you don't have exhaust back pressure, so you could have some seepage out of the turbo.
All right.
Do you know how many miles are on the engine since the last rebuild?
235. And he said he took it down to the block and replaced everything now.
Sounds like a would be okay to me. I think your problem with that black smoke would be a minor repair.
All right. Well, that's good to hear.
Al, do you know if the oil that's currently in the truck has any miles on it?
It has some. He said that the truck hasn't been run much for the last, I don't know, maybe 8 months or so, but it's been run a little, and I don't think he's changed it recently.
If there's 10,000 miles or more, I would pull an oil sample, and that may point us in the right direction. But again, you know, based on what you're explaining and Bruce just said it, even if there is a problem causing the smoke, it doesn't sound like it's going to be anything major.
Okay. If I get just a regular sample cup to put it in, can I send it to you to have it, or send it to your labs that you use?
Yeah, what you do, though, you want to order the sample kit. So it comes with the bottle, comes with the paperwork, comes with the mailer for it. You order the kit, we get it out to you. You could go pull a sample ahead of time, put it in any good, clean bottle, and then when you get the kit, pour into the bottle that's in there, fill out the paperwork, and send it in and take a look at it.
Okay. Well, I can do that.
All right, good stuff. We're going to keep rolling right along here. We're heading off to Colorado this time. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Nice, great show. See, I have a Detroit DDEC 3, and it's the 430-470. And I want to know, I drive pretty light-footed. I probably do about 60 miles an hour majority of the time. I want to have my ECM turned up, but I'm debating on do I go with the what you guys call the 585 or go to whatever the 550 horse. I think you guys had like a 585 is what I heard. But which one would I get? Would I maximize my mileage out of?
Leroy, I'll let you answer this one.
I would go with not the 585. I would go with the much lighter 500 program is what we call it. It's a factory Detroit 500 does about 430, 440 to the wheels. Our 500 does pretty much 500, 520 at the wheels. It gives you a good boost of power, but not too much, and you would generally see some better fuel economy out of it.
Okay, so the 500 horse then.
Yes.
So that 500 horse to the wheels is actually 588 at the flywheel. That's assuming a 15% loss through your drivetrain. Most of the dealerships and engine manufacturers will tell you you have a 20% loss. So let's take 500 divided by 0.8. That would be 625 horse. We feel that we lose in today's transmissions and rears about 15%, and I've seen some as low as 12%. So you can figure that'll take you up to 588 horsepower or give you a little over 100 more than what you have right now. And we've noticed over the years, if you give a guy 100 more horsepower than what he currently has, he's usually pretty thrilled with it, and he sees not only driving pleasure, but longer engine life and better fuel mileage.
Yep, and I wouldn't end up with black smoke out of the stack and stuff.
No. Black smoke means your injectors are bad. And if you have black smoke between shifts, you could be rolling into the throttle too hard. Always remember, it takes 8 pounds of turbo boost to turn black smoke into clear. So if you grab a gear and you're being slow and you lose all your boost and you just romp onto the throttle, that's going to give you black smoke. So
okay.
You look at your boost gauge and you roll in and you be gentle until you're up to 8 or 10 pounds of boost, and then you can get after the throttle.
Yep.
You shouldn't be getting
after
the throttle hard enough anyway because it's just hard on drive tires.
Yep. Well, that's why I don't have black smoke, because I see other people driving. I always see that puff between shifting or whatever, and, you know, I had somebody riding beside me and I was on the CB, and I asked them right out, you know, do I have black smoke coming out of my exhaust? And they said, no, it's just turns a tiny, you know, where you can see the exhaust, and then it disappears. I said, well, I must be driving right then.
You should always have a spot mirror, a little spot mirror, looking up at your stack.
Yep, I got to get one of those.
Don't look at it at nighttime, though, whenever there's lights behind you, because you see the vapors coming out, and you'll think it's smoke, and it's not. It's just heat vapors.
Yep. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Great stuff, guys. I had lots of things I wanted to jump in there, Bruce, because I have that program in my engine, and I absolutely love it. But we are we're really out of time. Anything you guys want to close with? We have about a minute.
Oh, I had a thought there. Leroy, do you have anything you want to say? Oh, I have something. We have one
go.
Of our signature 6NZ Caterpillar engines ready to go into a glider kit. The last one we did, we removed an acert out of a 379 and put in the R6NZ, which is set at about 700 horsepower. And he stopped in. He's had it for a year now. He's up 1.5 miles to the gallon. He's from Youngstown, Ohio, and he's an ex-Marine, 65 years old, from Vietnam Marine, and he said he saved $34,000 this year having that engine.
Outstanding. Great stuff. Bruce, I wish we had more time, but the music says I've got to get out of here. If you have any questions for Pittsburgh Power, give them a call. It's 724-360-4080. We'll see you back here next time. Thanks for joining me. Be safe, be profitable, be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, we are we're switching over to Destination Health. We're going to do a couple things here. Kim's been screening calls. She's going to come on and host with me. Lisa's been working. She's going to come on and start screening calls. She's going to go through the board right now, start looking for Destination Health calls. So if you have any questions on health, fit, nutrition, diet, whatever it might be, press 1 on your phone. We'll start grabbing those. And while they're getting ready, I'm going to drop the call and dial back into our phone system because I was getting some reports that my line was breaking up. It'll be fine on the recording, but I want to make sure we get that cleared up. So give us about 3 minutes here, and we will come back and get started on Destination Health. All right, everybody, we're getting set up here. We're going to roll through right now. We're looking for Destination Health questions, and Lisa's getting ready to screen some calls. So if you have any questions health-related, let's get them lined up. And I'll tell you right now, there's a bunch of questions on the board. We just need to go through some of these. I don't have a lot of material this week. I could always talk about health all show, but we have lots of room for questions. So if you've got questions, comments, topics, health-related, fitness, nutrition, diet, this is your chance. Most shows, we never get to all the questions by the end, but press 1 on your phone, and we will start screening those, and we'll be coming to you here shortly.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Welcome to our world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. Joining me today, my co-host, Kim Crocker, here. This is Destination Health. The website is letstruck.com. We also have the Destination Health Facebook page. Check that out. This is the show that's all about
you, your health, your fitness, your nutrition. And we wrap it all around that trucking lifestyle because we know that it's a challenge being on the road and trying to stay healthy. So that's what we talk about here on the show. We're going to get to your calls in just a little bit. Kim, welcome back to the show.
Hi, glad to be here. These weeks go by fast, especially during the holidays.
They do. It's good. You know, the holidays are always fun. It's a great time of year. But I'll tell you, by the time New Year's rolls around, I am so looking forward to getting back into a routine and kind of get back to work. And, you know, we just did the live show over the weekend for the New Year's, and it was just really fun. I don't have a really strong routine. I mean, you've been around here. You know what it's like around our house.
Mm-hmm.
You work at all kinds of weird hours and don't work at weird hours. But something about the holidays, by the time, you know, from Thanksgiving through New Year's, by the time it's over, I'm just ready to get back to normal.
Yeah.
Or abnormal or whatever it might be.
Yeah, there we go. We'll take it. Yeah,
yeah,
I agree. And, you know, it just makes you realize and be grateful for the times that, you know, when things are back in our control. And, you know, so I think John admits that one time on the show as a caller that, you know, when you're eating bad or, you know, anything off, it makes you appreciate when you got it rolling right, you know, and in line.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, this holiday season was interesting for me. This is typically a time of year where people just don't eat that well. You know, there's a lot of food, period, and a lot of it just isn't the healthiest food. We tend to do a lot more desserts. We do a lot more appetizers and party food. For a lot of people, there tends to be more alcohol. And I was going into this season saying, if I want to eat something, I'm just going to eat it. You know, it's the holiday season. I'm not going to be super strict on what I eat. The interesting thing was, I really didn't eat bad at all because I didn't want to. There was nothing this year that really tempted me to say, boy, I really want to eat that and I'm going to do it. You know, on a couple of the meals, Thanksgiving and Christmas, I kind of went a little higher in carbs than I normally do, but it was things like sweet potatoes. You know, it wasn't like I was, and we did some, Lisa did some great paleo desserts, you know, a killer cheesecake with a nut crust. They were pretty low in sugar compared to most desserts, and they had no grain or wheat or anything. And I ate some of those, and I had a great time. I didn't feel like I was depriving myself of anything because, like I said, I just wasn't craving any of it. And I felt good, and I still feel good. So as far as food and that, this was a great holiday season for me.
Well, then on the other I always kind of preach that, you know, the holidays, they're only really 2 days maybe or three, four.
Yeah.
I had personally 16 full-blown holidays, and it made me think about, you know, our drivers and everything out there, because I know some would say, you know, they have control when they're in their truck and they're on the road, and then when they're home, you know, not so much. And so mine was kind of the same. I was away from our home here, and we were back in Ohio, which I still consider home, but out of where I felt more in control. Even though I had a plan going in, I did let myself fall off plan, and not completely, so it lasts, you know, now farther into January, you reel it back in to getting back to the basics. But, man, I've been doing a lot of reflecting on that, to tell you the truth.
You know, and I read this a long, long time ago, and it really struck me as interesting back then. And then with all my reading recently, I went back and did more research on it. And, you know, we talk about the cold and flu season, which we're heading into what they consider to be the worst part of it right now, from now through about March or so. And, you know, I grew up in Ohio. A lot of people in the U.S. live in cold climates where we really see winter weather. And the thought always was that it's the cold winter weather causing colds and flus.
But if you look at the statistics, the same thing happens in warm climates. It's no different in Florida than it is in Ohio. The cold and flu season happens about the same time. And we know that cold does not cause disease. There's nothing about cold air. You know, we've all been told that don't go out with your hair wet, you'll catch a cold. That's absolutely false. You could run around naked at, you know, 10 below zero, wet, and that will not cause cold or flu. We know that there has to be a germ or bacteria present to cause disease. Well, then the thought was, okay, well, you get sick more often in the wintertime then because the house is closed up, the cars are closed up, you're in closed offices. The problem is, if that were the case, you should see more disease, colds and flus in the summertime in the South. Because you're in Florida, you probably have windows and doors open most of the time this time of year, don't you?
Yeah, actually today, because it's a little bit cooler, so it was nice too, exactly.
Yeah, so, but in the summertime in Florida, you never open windows. You've got the air conditioner cranked up all the time. So if it were a case of we're in more enclosed spaces, then we should see the inverse in the South. We should see that happen in the summertime, but it doesn't. The cold and flu season happens in Florida the same time it happens in the North. So if it's not the cold weather, it's not the fact that we're shut up in more confined spaces, so the germs are spreading easier, then what is it? Why is this the time of year where we get colds and flus? And the theory is, starting around Thanksgiving, we start eating really poorly, and we get stressed. A lot of people really stress through the holidays. You know, it's supposed to be a time to be joyous and celebrate, and we take more time off, but a lot of people really get stressed out during the holidays. So the theory is that it's really a lot more about our diet and our stress levels from Thanksgiving through the holidays, and then not long after that we see all the colds and flus.
You know, I really believe that. Yeah, I've always heard that we actually usually have the germs and stuff on us already. You know, it's just when our immune system's low is when it gets in and causes the,
exactly,
the sickness.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same reason why one person in a house may or may not get sick when four or five other people in the house did. You clearly know the germs, the viruses, the bacteria are all present. They're all over the place. You couldn't avoid them if you're in that house. And yet, why doesn't somebody get sick? Well, more than likely, their immune system is a whole lot stronger. We don't get sick every time we're exposed to a sickness. Both things have to occur. Our bodies can handle a lot of germs and viruses and bacteria and fight it off, and we don't even know it's happening. It's when our immune system becomes weak that we really notice what's going on when those things are around.
Yeah, and you know, it's the whole idea of stress. I'd love to have us do a show on that too, because it goes in that vicious cycle where, you know, even we're focusing on being extra healthy and changing eating habits out there, and then then stress comes in based off work or family or whatever, and then it derails the very thing, you know, with eating healthy that will make us be able to deal with all of it even better. So love to get people's communication, you know, some conversation going about stress and stress relief and so forth.
Yeah, and so many things about our health are kind of a vicious cycle. So what happens is now you get sick. There's a good chance you may have to take off work. You're not going to be as effective. You could fall farther behind on things. You're not eating as well. And then that causes more stress. And the stress then starts to affect your sleep, and the sickness starts to affect your sleep. The less we sleep, the sicker we get. And it really can be a vicious cycle that's hard to get out of.
Yeah.
Well, there's
the
music. We've got some questions, so we're going to get to a break, and we're going to come back right after this and get to your calls and questions. Stick around. We'll be right back with more stuff
Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is Destination Health. Kim Cocker, him, is my co-host. Kim, there's lots and lots of stuff we could talk about, but what do you say we grab some calls?
That sounds great.
All right. Let's head off to California. James, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, Kevin? And Kim?
Good. What's on your mind?
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention something. I picked up some raw dairy products. I picked up some butter, cream, and milk. And I don't know if I can go back to Kerrygold because now my coffee is like a living food, it seems like. And
well,
I also got the milk, and I'm
going
to clabber it into whey and curds. So, well, curds
excellent.
And whey. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty. Are you familiar with the clabbering process or curds and whey? I just learned about that. Thought it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I am. I've actually made I've made my own raw milk cheese, and the process of separating milk into curds and whey is the first step in the cheese making process, and then there are other processes we can use to culture dairy into things like sour cream and clotted cream and double cream and obviously yogurt. And the different, all the methods are very, very similar. The difference is either the type of enzymes or the type of bacteria we introduce to the milk to make it happen.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I just thought it was really cool. You know, I guess that would probably be the easiest thing being on the road, you know, to do, you know, pour the milk into a jar is what I'm doing, you know, and just letting it sit. I just started it, so, you know, I thought it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's surprising how easy it is to make some of the fresh cheeses. Like a fresh mozzarella is really simple. We introduce, like I say, there's rennet and bacteria and enzymes different ways, and that's really how we come up with different cheeses. I mean, cheese is milk and salt. Those are the only basic ingredients. So how do we get all these different cheeses if there's hardly any ingredients in there? And it's the different bacteria or enzymes that create different end products. But the first step is putting in an agent of some sort that separates the curd from the whey. And it's the curd that we make most cheeses out of. And making a fresh mozzarella is really just about separating those two and then heating up the curds that are left. And within, I mean, you can make fresh mozzarella in less than an hour.
Yeah, I hope I'm able to find it elsewhere. I mean, I'm in California right now, but I know the brand is Organic Pastures. And it's available at some of these, you know, health food stores, like, you know, organic places. But I visited a PCC in Seattle, where my brother lives, like a co-op. Oh, my God, I was
right.
in heaven in that place. I'm sure they're available there where you are, right, Morgan?
Believe it or not, not commercially in grocery stores. I'm shocked about that because Oregon is such a leader in so many good food products. Like the organic standard really started in Oregon. A lot of foods you'll see, they're certified by the organic or the Oregon Tilth. And that's like the gold standard for organic. This is where the whole fresh, local, artisan food movement started. And yet Oregon is one of those states where it is illegal to sell raw dairies in grocery stores. I live on the Washington border. I mean, I'm literally right here. I'm looking at Washington right now. And I can go right across the river, and in Washington, it is legal to buy raw dairy. Now, in Oregon, I can buy what's called a herd share. So I can go directly to the farm, I pay them, and I get a portion of all the products that are produced. So I can do that, but I can't go to a grocery store here in Oregon and buy raw dairy.
Right. Yeah, I read that it was illegal in, like, 18 states, but...
Oh, it's crazy.
We're fighting,
like here in Oregon, marijuana is illegal, but raw milk isn't.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm kind of happy that marijuana is illegal. I'm good with that, but I wish they'd put a little common sense to it and let me buy raw dairy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really hard to get into these places unless I'm Bobtail. You know, but it's like now it's like I almost have a higher standard.
I'm sure you do.
But
people
not
don't realize
Marigold,
how
but...
much better. No, I totally agree. Most people don't realize how much better those products are.
Yeah, and I mean I don't know if I can go back now. I mean I don't know. You know, I just have to see what happens. But now that I've tried it, it even has a different flavor. And I never have a problem stirring my Bulletproof. I know you've talked about that before, but I'm able to stir it, and it works out pretty well. You know, and I add the cream now. And apparently it has a long, it doesn't expire like regular milk, you know. So that's another thing. It doesn't,
that's correct.
The pasteurization will, you know, cause it to go bad, regular milk, but unpasteurized milk just kind of ages. So it's another fermentation thing. It's pretty cool.
It is. We do two things to milk that just totally wipe out all the nutritional benefits. First, we pasteurize it, which kills not only – we pasteurize in case there's bad bacteria in there. Well, we started pasteurizing – because of crowded factory farm conditions where the cows weren't as healthy as they should be. They were in feedlots. They weren't out eating fresh green grass all the time. They were stuck in stalls and barns and milked, and we started seeing a lot of bad bacteria in milk. So they started pasteurizing to get rid of the bad bacteria. The problem is you get rid of all the bacteria. You kill everything that's in there. You kill the enzymes, you kill the good bacteria, but they had to do that to make milk safe because of the way they were raising the cows. Then the next step is we homogenize it. Now, the only reason to homogenize is purely convenience. People didn't like the fact that the cream would separate and come to the top and the skim milk would be left on the bottom and you would have to shake it up or stir it or mix it. So we started homogenizing milk. That actually hurts the nutritional value of the milk and damages the fats so that they are now unhealthy for our body. So it's no wonder we have people with allergies to dairy and intolerance to dairy because it's not dairy anymore. It came out of a cow, but the cow wasn't healthy to begin with. It's loaded with hormones and antibiotics. And then we just murder the stuff with pasteurization and homogenization, and then we wonder why it's not really all that great of a food. If you're eating raw dairy products and raw cultured dairy products, they are extremely healthy.
Yeah, and a lot more digestible.
a lot of times.
Yeah, exactly, because
that may be lactose intolerant.
Yeah, they have the enzymes in there that help break down the lactose. So if and there are adults who don't produce those enzymes, so that's why they're lactose intolerant. Most of the population is. But if you're eating or drinking raw or cultured or raw cultured, then the lactose and the milk proteins aren't a problem because the culturing digests the lactose. The enzymes that are naturally occurring help break down the proteins. Nature really knew what they were doing. In almost all these foods, and then we screw them up. What do you think, Kim?
Yeah. And you know what? It's fascinating to me about the raw milk because I'm not a big milk person. But again, it's one of those things that just because of the show and everybody talking about it, it's like, I'm going to try this, you know? And that's what I love about it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a shame. And it has nothing to do with health. It's been proven so many times that good, sustainable raw milk products where the animals were raised properly is far safer and healthier, way healthier. We can't even argue that one. But it's even safer than pasteurized milk that comes from these factory farms. There have been zero deaths reported on raw milk products. We have lots and lots of cases of people contracting horrible illnesses from contaminated milk. It's just not raw. So the pasteurization doesn't guarantee that it's going to be safe, and we have more problems with pasteurized milk. Pretty typical, though. Stick around. We're going to get right to a break, and then we're going to come back and get to more of your calls and questions. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rothbard. The website, letstruck.com. This is Destination Health. You can also go to our Destination Health Facebook page. And we're going to get right back to some phone calls. Let's go to Minnesota. Dean, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. One question that I really have here is I need to get started on this ketogenic and stuff. You gave out a gentleman's name that you talked about that would have a book and a CD that I could listen to during the day, because my job is basically I can't stop. It's a money job where I got to just keep running constantly, so I can't stop for dinner and whatever. So I'll take some summer sausage, cut that all up, put it in my cooler, and that's what I munch on during the day is just summer sausage. But, you know, most of the time it doesn't, you know, work all right, but I've also got diabetes and high blood pressure, so a couple of times I've gotten a diabetic shake because I haven't stopped and eaten decent, you know. But time is money on my job, and
Got it. So I want to just clarify real quick, and that is that we talk a lot about keto and paleo, and many times I throw them in. Part of the reason I do that
is because I tend to eat a combination of both. I like the ideas from both of those, but they're different. Paleo refers to eating the way our ancestors ate, as close as possible, eating to the way we ate when we were hunter-gatherers. So wild animals, lots of animal products, foraging for, you know, wild nuts and seeds and berries and whatever vegetables we could get. And there really were no grains. We didn't eat grains. And we didn't eat sugar. That stuff didn't exist back then. So that's kind of the paleo, a clean, ancestral, natural diet. Ketogenic refers to the balance of macronutrients. You know, high fat, moderate protein, low carb. You could eat a paleo diet that was nowhere near ketogenic, and you could eat a ketogenic diet that was loaded with a lot of really bad food. That's why I like the combination of the two. I like the high-fat, low-carb, moderate protein, but I also like the idea of eating our ancestral diet, eating the way we ate when we were hunter-gatherers. So I think the book and the person you're referring to is on the ketogenic side, and that is, I drew a total blank. Keto Clarity is the name of the book. Jimmy Moore. Jimmy Moore. He has a book called Keto Clarity. He has some keto cookbooks. I will tell you, though, that Jimmy Moore is not, I think he's changing some, but a lot of his material, he doesn't lean towards the paleo side all that much. He isn't really that strict on eating real clean, eating grass-fed, pastured animals. He does focus more on the ketogenic side. Now, the paleo side, the guy, there's a doctor who started that called Lauren Cordain decades ago, actually. And it's growing like crazy. Paleo is way more popular than keto. You can find tons and tons of resources on paleo.
Yeah, my question is, like that summer sausage is probably, obviously it's grain-fed, so some of the products you don't really want to eat in there, but is that still a good meal? And some of the, you know, granola bars and all that stuff, I've tried to eat those and I just can't.
You know, summer sausage, try to get it from the best source possible. There are some good, clean summer sausages out there. Most aren't, but I eat those. I am not 100% strict on this because it's still too difficult to find a lot of those foods. I seek them out when I can get them, but I'm not going to stress over eating food that isn't exactly the way I want it. This isn't an all-or-nothing lifestyle. This is, think about eating the best you can and don't stress when you can't. The one thing I really don't cheat on, because it's easy not to cheat, is my macronutrient balance. There's always food available. I can eat at McDonald's if I need to and stay within my macronutrient balance. Now, it's obviously not paleo. It's not clean food, but I'm not going to stress over that. I'll seek it out when I can find it, and if I can't, I'll just do the best I can.
I go to the meat lockers, and that's the only place I'll buy the hamburger and the steaks and that type, you know, over the greasy, you know, Walmart grocery store type of summer sausage. I mean, I do get better material, but I was just wondering if the corn-fed stuff still, if it was helping or not.
It is, in the sense that you're staying within your macronutrient balance. That is going to help a lot. We can go even further and go to the grass-fed and those kind of things, but again, I don't want you to stress over it. Do the best you can, and when you can't get those products, then just get the best you can. Kim, I know you and I have talked about this many times, and I want to
kind of get across to people. Don't stress about this, because
yeah.
part of this healthy lifestyle is not being stressed out all the time.
Right. And, you know, and especially don't use that as an excuse that you can't get the grass fed or you can't get this. It's, you know, when just any shift, you know, start inching it, you know, if people can't go there completely, inch your way towards it. And I think that's one of the best advices that we've shared on the show, Kevin, that you just said right there. Just try to do the best you can. Times you can't, but even in McDonald's, yeah, you can get a salad and a chicken breast and make it work. So great.
Yeah, or I'll get a burger without the bun. Give me extra
mm-hmm.
lettuce. Give me extra veggies
mm-hmm.
and make it a cheeseburger. I don't care. Make it a double cheeseburger
yep.
with bacon. You know,
yep, exactly.
And I'll be just fine. One of my favorite meals, and you can get this at virtually every restaurant now. No matter what restaurant I go into, I'll look at the burger menu because everybody has, you know, six or seven different burgers, mushrooms, bacon,
mm-hmm.
you know, pot burger, whatever it might be. I'll find my favorite burger. Then I'll go look in the salad menu, and there's usually lots of choices of salad, and I'll find my favorite salad on the menu. And I'll just tell them, put the burger with all the works on top of that salad. I
mm-hmm.
absolutely love that, and you can get that
it
at
is.
Every restaurant.
It's awesome, yeah, yeah. And you start finding you don't miss the bread. You honestly don't.
I am to the point now where I would much rather eat it like that than I would rather eat it as a burger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, now I look at it and say, my God, why haven't I been doing this all my life? I like this much better. It's more satisfying. You get the fresh of the salad. You get, you know, the yumminess of the burger and the bacon and the cheese and the mushrooms and all that other stuff you want that would be on the burger. And you just tell them to throw it on top of a salad.
Yeah.
Let's, I think somewhere on the board here, there he is. We're going to bring in one of our clean food farming experts. Matt, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Kevin and Kim.
Hey, Matt.
Good afternoon.
Talking about raw milk always gets me worked up.
Yes.
Well, I'll start with a couple of websites to help people that want to try to find it. Unfortunately, it's not easy. One of them is eatwild.com, and there's right on their homepage, there's a link for Find Farms, and then it'll bring up the state of the United States. You just click on a state, there'll be all kinds of farms to look at. As far as raw milk is concerned, Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, they have the national list, because it changes state by state, like Kevin was saying, for the rules on raw milk. And believe it or not, in some states, it's actually illegal to advertise and selling it.
Oh, unbelievable. Hey, Matt, hold that thought. We're going to come back to you right after the break. We've got to get to a break. Boy, this show just flies by. So we'll be right back. Stick around. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Kim Cockerham is my co-host. This is Destination Health, and we were talking with Matt before the break about raw milk and other things. Matt, go ahead.
Okay. So the other thing you brought up about factory farming, and this goes back much further than most people realize, because when we think about factory farming today, it kind of started in the 60s, 70s, it, you know, went mainstream. But believe it or not, when it comes to milk and dairy products, it started around the turn of the 1900s, and it started in major cities, and that's when they started, I don't know exact dates, but probably by 1920 is when laws were going into effect for pasteurization. And the reason for it was the larger cities, they were moving the farms, you know, closer to town. And brewery, you know, back prohibition and all that was real popular. They, you know, that was always in the major cities, and all the distillates from the leftover grain. They needed to find something to do with all the waste. That's when they started feeding it to cattle, to the dairy farms close to the cities, so the milk was close to the people. And that's when they started to have problems.
Cattle
are
ruining those kind of stories, and you were the one that told me that, and it's interesting how one thing leads to another, then we create a problem, and then we create what we think is a solution for the problem, but it really just creates more problems.
Yeah, because in reality, you know, everybody knows, you know, if they know anything about dairy farms and they chop silage for feed, that, believe it or not, that's not even a good diet for a cow. Their ruminant stomach is a fermentation tank. And silage actually starts to ferment on its own in the silo. And that alone, eating silage, will change the pH in the cow, and it'll change the bacteria level in the milk. They really shouldn't be eating anything but straight grass or hay.
Yeah, and, you know, their natural diet for animals like that, they would seek out fast-growing green grass. When they can eat fast-growing green grass, that's when they're the healthiest. And then that's when their products, whether it's meat or milk or whatever, that's when that is the healthiest for us.
Yep. It, another just wild, strange fact about our backwards government and the rules they create, it has been proven that in beef cattle that are fed on feedlots and fed grain, that's where a lot of the E. coli comes from, is the bacteria change and in the manure. If they were fed straight grass, we would almost never have to worry about E. coli. It almost wouldn't happen. And they actually even figured that if feedlot cattle were moved to grass and hay 2 weeks before, if that's all they ate for the last 2 weeks before they were slaughtered, that would probably solve the problem right there.
That's crazy, because we do the opposite in this country. Lots and lots of farms still exist where people raise their cattle and their animals on grass. They raise them on pasture. The problem is, there's lots of problems, but because of the system, they end up sending those cows to a feedlot for the last part of its life, 30, 60, 90 days, whatever it might be. And then they are force-fed grains and antibiotics and corn to fatten them up, and it wipes out all of – it doesn't matter if that cow was on grass its whole life, that last part – wipes out all of the benefits and creates all of the problems. And you're saying if we just did it the other way and just put them on grass for a couple weeks at the end, it would fix some of these problems.
Yeah, and there actually is two different types you can buy. There's what's called grass-fed, and then there's also grass-finished.
Right.
And grass-fed is better. You're going to have much more omega-3s, but just grass finished alone is quite an improvement as far as the health is concerned.
Exactly. Hey, great stuff as always, Matt. Thanks for jumping in. Kim, we've got some more calls here. I'm looking at the time. You know, it's always such a challenge. This hour goes by so fast, and you and I both have things we like to talk about, and we've got calls. Anything you want to make sure you get in this week?
You know what? Thanks for saying that. Yeah, I want to share, and I'll share it on the Facebook page. Brittany, part of our team, and I'm biased because she's my awesome daughter, has put up a blog called thewholeidea.wordpress.com to kind of journal her journey on this. And she shared a great thing. I think all of us can relate, where you can look to see what didn't work and identify what you can do to make that work then for you. So I loved that way that she did that. So I want everybody to let us know at support@letstruck.com, like how we can support. Like, what do they need? Accountability. They need ideas. You know, they come here for the questions and that. So just trying to build on that a little bit to see how we can support everybody out there.
Excellent, excellent. I love that. I'll go check that out. We get so busy around here sometimes, and the team is all spread out all over the country, so sometimes I don't even know what they're doing. I'd love to go see that.
Yeah, great.
Excellent. Let's try to squeeze in a call or two. Let's go to Wisconsin. Harold, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. Hey, just a refresher from a couple weeks ago or so, the question was about the gallbladder being removed. Then you mentioned some kind of supplement that a person could take.
Yes.
And what was
now,
that? Some kind of salt or something?
Yeah, let me kind of jump back and start at the beginning, and then I'll tell you exactly what that was. My number one recommendation for anybody who wants to improve their health through nutrition and eat a better diet and solve some of their health problems. If you have medical conditions, you've got to stick with your MD for now. Maybe not forever, but for now, stick with your MD. Find an NTP, a nutritional therapy practitioner, to work with you and your MD, and they will approach things from a totally different point of view. They are going to look over your lifestyle, your diet. They're going to do a full physical exam. They're going to do testing. And then they're going to make recommendations about diet and supplements to overall improve general health and target certain issues. They are very, very good solving medical issues with diet and lifestyle and some limited supplementation. So that's always my recommendation. I have very limited information when I'm trying to answer questions for people on the phone, and I can only answer them generally. So I want people to know you really need to get to a naturopath, possibly a chiropractor, but now that I've been through the program, I really recommend an NTP. So with the gallbladder removed, the problem is we no longer are able to digest fats very effectively at all. So we might be eating the right fats and we might be eating the right amount, but the gallbladder was the control mechanism to release bile, and bile is what digests fats. Without the gallbladder, you still have bile, but it's not working very well at all. It's a slow, steady drip, whether you have a lot of fat or no fat, and that's not optimal. So what you do is you supplement by eating bile salts with a meal. That way you have the enzymes and the bile salts you need with the food. And if you know you're going to be eating a high-fat meal, you can take more bile salts. So there's nothing really dangerous about supplementing with bile salts on your own, but I would really recommend that you work with an NTP so that they can identify other problems and find the best solutions.
All right. Thank you much on that, Kevin. And you have yourself a happy new year and very prosperous.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Kim, that you know, earlier I was trying to stress we really want people not to stress over, you know, getting this perfect. The other thing I really want to stress is we are answering questions very generally, and I would love to see people start working with health practitioners who understand this stuff.
Yeah, which I shared with you. I go to one tomorrow that I found through us, you know, sharing that Paleo Physicians, you know, network. There's somebody who believes in the same philosophy and are trained in it. So.
Exactly. And I can't wait to hear your results. And I'm sure we'll be talking about it next week right here on this show. So stay tuned for that. Kim, thanks as always. Great stuff. The hour went way too fast. We've got to get out of here. Be safe. Be profitable, be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, Kim, thanks as always. Anything final before we shut this off?
Oh, thank you so much, Kevin. Love being here, and thanks to everybody for being here as well. Have a great week.
Perfect. Good luck tomorrow. Have fun with it, and let me know how it goes.
Absolutely, I will.
All right, take care, everybody.